the Western Mass Young Society, or Young Center, for our lecture tonight. Wait a minute. You can go to westmassyoung.org to find out all about us. And if you want, I'm going to pass a paper around if you want to get on our email list so that we send out notices every month. Okay, so please turn off your cell phone. We're about to take off. And to let you know, there will be no break, but if you really need to go to the restroom, there's one right alcohol here, so just sort of sneak out and sneak back in. And as a nonprofit, of course, we are here because you help us, so the donation baskets are at either door, so we hope that you can help us continue to bring these lectures to the public. Okay, so I'm just going to say a few things, a few more announcements. Next month, it's usually the second Friday of every month, except for May, it will be different. And the next time I will be speaking on active imagination, accessing our creative imagination.
Yep, we're turning them off.
Turn them off, okay. And actually in Hartford on the January 18th, I'm going to be doing the Jung Spirituality from the Body, if you missed that last year and you want to see it again, because it has video stuff to it. So go to the Connecticut Association for Jungian Psychology and you can find the information for that. Okay, two new things are happening tonight, which are very exciting. Dan, our wonderful board member and webmaster, we're starting an archive library on our website. So Thayer Green has given us permission to record this, which is wonderful. Then we can just put it on. A number of people who couldn't be here said, oh, I wish you guys were recording this. So we are. And we'll get anybody that will give us permission, we will continue to record these. And Peter, a former board member, has recordings from amazing people, like David Hart, who was a specialist in fairy tales, who died a couple of years ago, right? From Boston, so we're going to set that up. If you do not want a comment or a question recorded, please just say no recording, and Dan's going to be in charge of the recording, and he'll just turn off the recorder while you're speaking. Okay, let's see. So afterwards we're starting something. Carol Beauvais, who's also a board member, has a beautiful house, and she has a salon where she invites very amazing people. And so we're gathering after this for tea and hot cider and yummies to talk, to socialize, talk more about the subject, whatever we feel like doing. And we might see how it goes. I know tonight is Christmas night. You know, it's getting, everybody needs to be somewhere else. But we're going to hopefully continue this so we can get more connection with each other. And the directions for her house are up here on the door. You just go up South Street, and then you can and ask Carol. Right, Carol, can you?
Hi. It's literally about 4 minutes driving.
Yeah.
So
you can ask Carol or me if you're confused about the directions, if you want to come.
We'd love to have you. Fireplace, comfortable, and easy conversation.
And I should have brought the red book, but next time I will. Okay. It's 40 Manham Street, in case anybody knows where that is. Okay, I think that's all. And we're also lucky to have Nomi Kluger-Nash on our board, and she's going to introduce our speaker, Thayer Green. So, welcome.
Big house. I wrote this today, which means that I don't have it inside of me, though I have so much of my past with Thayer inside of me that I don't dare be too much impromptu. I'll have to read it. We are told on the website that tonight we present, this is a quote, on being a couple with Thayer Greene. Did anybody read it that way? I take that to mean that tonight we are all coupling with Thayer Greene.
This is quite a harem.
This coupling could be the ideal way of lecturing. We'll see how it works out. Once upon a time in New York, a little over half a century ago, about 1961, I believe, I belonged, and still do, to the New York Foundation and would attend their seminars and their lectures regularly. And in those days, the trainees at the Jung Institute would also attend the seminars. As usual, I would sit in the rear, and I would laugh when something humorous was said. I would laugh loud and alone. One day, one evening, I heard this Jupiterian, jovial burst of laughter. And I looked down the aisle to see from whence this came. And a few aisles down, there was a young fellow who turned around and looked at me because he wanted to see who that other person was who was laughing. And our eyes met, and we smiled and nodded in the companionship of those who laugh. I find laughter the most healing thing, not only joyful, but healing. It brings the warmth of the fire that melts and transforms. Thereafter, I saw him a few times in the hallway, walking tall, wearing his suit and waistcoat and watch fob. When I reminded him of this a few years later, he said, "I never had such an outfit. You were seeing my persona." Thayer, hey, you're not smiling, Thayer. Thayer hails from a conservative minister background, so he had every right to have that persona. But it has melded and remelded through the process of individuation, of transformation, and he has many personae. I have seen him as so many different kinds of characters, and this did remind me of the way he ended an article that appeared in Quadrant, the centennial issue of Quadrant in 1975. He wrote an article called Confessions of an Extrovert. So I found that again and copied it so I could read you what he wrote at the end. "The many faces and multiple personae of the extroverted attitude may seem to be only disguise and evasion, but they are in fact the peculiar wisdom and richness that a creative extroversion can offer to each of us." I think he's lived up to that. I see Thayer mainly as a friend, the attributes of a friend and a companion. What can be more precious than that? He, of course, is also the teacher. He hasn't lost that part of the persona. He can propound things, but with warmth and caring about the subject and the people to whom he's speaking, to whom he's teaching. Mainly, I see him as a friend. He was one of the young ones in those days, and I still see him as a young one. No, that's funny. He's considered the elder here. I still see him as a young guy, and I think that's not only due to the fact that I'm old and that my first impression has become ingrained in me, but that he is open-minded and curious and flexible within his structure. Within his structure, he is flexible. One of the arts that he has done very well, as has Anita, the two of them, they can belong to an institution and bring about an innovation within the tradition of the institution. I think that is an amazing thing to do. It's something I've never been able to leave. But he stays in the institution, stays in his own structure, and within that is flexible and innovative. And as a true extrovert, is open-mindedly curious as to what is out there. Now, I don't know if many of you know this, but he is one of the ones who began the group therapy as part of the training in the New York Institute. I understand from him that it's no longer the case, and that's a great shame. You don't have any idea, coming from the generation of my parents that I did, of how group was considered. Group's not a bad thing, but to bring out the holiness of the internal, to bring out the holiness of one's internal processes to the open, to share with one another, is just not done. I mean, it's worse than group sex. But he managed to do that, and he did it well, and he converted me, because I also didn't want to believe in group therapy, but I came to understand how good he was at it because I was a member of his group. Thayer once said many years ago now that his rejoinder to the Jungian introverted bias, which demanded depth, I may not be deep, but I'm broad. But we've seen over the years the deepening of his breadth. So, leaving out all, just one more very important thing. You can argue with Thayer. This is a great gift. You don't have to pussyfoot, you don't have to go in sideways. You can have a good argument with him. It does help to have a good meal present, because he likes good food and drink. But you can argue and not be afraid of it. So, companion, adversary also, and friend. What can be more precious? Precious. These different ways, extroversion and introversion, innovation and tradition, should not be compared and contrasted, but honored as to what each brings to the other. They are as companions to one another, as played out within one's soul or in one's marriage. And so I think that's what we're going to hear about tonight.
I've just discovered the danger of being introduced by an old friend. Thank you, Nomi. I have taken on this evening what in some ways is an impossible subject. And this is a small portion of my research and thinking on it. And I do not have, fortunately, a lengthy set of pages. I have notes, and I'm not sure I can organize this subject. So I think of what I'm going to try to do as picking the petals off a daisy around a central theme, but it may seem a little bit fragmented and disorganized. One of the books that I read in preparation is a book by a Jungian analyst entitled "Impossible Love," and I get the sense that she writes from experience. From the way she describes it. But it's a very interesting book, thoughtful. It has both historical and Jungian components to it. And she begins with the story of Abelard and Heloise. How many of you are familiar with Abelard and Heloise? Well, I don't want to spend too much time. They lived in the 12th century, and he was a monk, and I think they met at the university. He taught there, and they became lovers, and I could go on and give all the details, but one of the things they did, which we don't do anymore, we send emails, They wrote letters to each other before, during, and after their intense romance. And they broke all of the rules, all of the norms, all of the codes of the time in their passionate encounter with each other. And part of the importance of the story of Abelard and Heloise is that this was a watershed in the history of love. This didn't exist essentially in the culture prior to the 12th century, where you have both Abelard and Heloise in their public romance, and you also have the beginning of courtly love, the troubadour and the lady and the knight in southern France, and where the feminine begins to be more fully valued. And this was a major change, and only a very small minority were involved in this, from what Jan Bauer writes: love between women and men was at best a byproduct, not a goal or even an expectation, in an age when marriages were arranged or determined almost solely by social and economic criteria. From much of my reading, I really don't think it was until the post-Victorian age that in the 20th century we began to experience the sense of freedom of the heart to choose the beloved, with all of its dangers, I might add. That's why she wrote on impossible love. It's a relatively new phenomenon, one which in some ways we now assume, but going back in human history for millennia, it didn't exist in the way we now have it. She writes, Eros at best was pagan instinct or sexuality, or in contrast, Eros being one form of love, agape was love toward God and neighbor and sublimation of one's own personal desire and longing for another. Emotional needs were simply not central. The idea of seeking and having a right to emotional fulfillment through relationship is a modern one. A third kind of amour, of love, amour, that began to emerge in the 12th century was a new path of loving of the eyes and the heart. So, you know, I've taken on the subject of love, and that was probably a grandiose effort on my part. But that's the background. James Hillman, who recently died, unfortunately, but many of you, I believe, are familiar with, wrote, "When people fall in love, not only eyes and lips and hearts meet, but theologies. We come to the encounter not only with love, but also with our idea of love." And there lies a very complicated and difficult problem, because we all have our own idea of what love is, and it is not necessarily shared by the object upon which we project it. So, we need always to be aware of our unconscious expectations, would be another way of putting it. One of our Jungian colleagues, Polly Young Eisendrath, has a book on couples counseling, which Anita and I do a fair amount of, and I have for many years. And the book is entitled, You're Not What I Expected. I think it's a wonderful description of what we're all up against. By falling in love, Abelard and Eloise fell out of the ordered collective system of the 12th century culture. They were forced to evolve in what would become an increasingly individual belief system. And this is still going on, ever changing through the centuries and the generations. In our own culture, in our own history over the last 50 years or so, we have seen the transformation that's occurred in relation to interracial marriage, for example. And now, same-sex marriage. And, of course, we always have Shakespeare to help us with Romeo and Juliet, that when the heart makes its demands upon us, we have to break out of the norms, the standards, the structures of our cultural environment, and often, very often, our familial environment, in order to lay claim to what the heart demands of us. Falling in love has nothing to do with willpower and everything to do with readiness, especially inner readiness. We are open to passion when we are open to change. I think that's a very important comment, even though I think very often the individual is not aware how open they are. It happens to them, and then they discover their capacity for change. The demands of love and of coupling are the capacity and the willingness to experience change in oneself. Robert Stein, a Jungian analyst, is quoted in Bauer's book, "There is no possibility for fulfilling the soul's desire for union until the child is transformed and healed. Its neglected and abused nature must be attended to before it becomes capable of loving." And he says also, "The deepest need of the soul in any human relationship is the desire to unite with the other." So, one of the things that is introduced by Stein there is that our capacity and the particular nature of our experience of love and our ability to express love will be rooted to a significant degree in our early childhood development. and how we experienced love being given to us, or experienced not being loved given to us. Those are going to be early markers in the creation of our particular character and of our instinctive capacity to give and receive love. Bauer goes on and says, "The other is many-faced. It is impossible to know in the time of passion whether the other is outside or inside, flesh or spirit, union with our own soul or with our lover." Again, I think that's a very insightful and profound observation. It raises one of the most common elements of falling madly in love, which is the phenomenon of projection. And those of you who are familiar with Jung's theories know that he understood that which was projected upon the other, a man upon a woman upon a man, I believe equally in same-sex relationships, there is projection. I'm not as knowledgeable about that. I'm hoping that maybe some here can add to what I am saying in this lecture. Is it our own soul, our own unconscious emotional makeup, our own ideals, our own dreams, that we see in the other? Or are we really, truly seeing the other in the other's essential being? That's the big question. And it obviously can be said that it's both, that both can be true. But, you know, in my own experience of 61 and a half years of marriage, we move from a fair amount of projection, and you're not what I expected experience, to discovering we really, really were very fortunate because we'd found the partner we were meant to have in this lifetime. And one of the things that Marie-Louise von Franz says about this subject is there is no possibility of generalizing about a particular relationship. It is unique, it is individual, it has its own rhythms, its own rituals, its own secrets, and it doesn't fit any general or collective norm. And that's part of why it's so fascinating, and I think has so much value and depth to it. This leads to Jung's concept of the conjunctio, namely the union of opposites. And what he's talking about here is that within each of us, whether we are male or female, we are dual in our nature. We are both masculine and feminine, feminine and masculine. And Jung is saying that the fundamental source of the capacity for being a lover is first to have had some deep joining and communion within ourselves of the two sides of our own nature, which then provides a bridge for us to meet the other. And I, you know, my sense is that's true in both heterosexual and in homosexual relationships. I could be corrected, but I think that's absolutely fundamental. And so, in other words, perhaps a simpler way of describing it is, it's going to be very difficult to be truly a lover of another person until you have become a lover of yourself, of your own wholeness, of your own inner depths, and of your own opposites that are in tension with each other. That somehow, as there is communication and balance and union between two sides of yourself, that will be the bridge for you to meet the other in his or her two-sidedness and give you a capacity to accept tension, conflict in a relationship. It's inevitable. And, you know, we have archetypal images of this union of the opposites. Most of you are probably familiar with yin and yang, soul and luna, heaven and earth, matter and spirit, the heavenly marriage, the philosopher's stone, the golden flower, part of what Jung affirms is this union leads to creativity. Out of the joining comes the child, the new birth, the new possibility, the capacity for change. Turning to projection again, projection precedes insight. We don't choose to project. Projection happens, and it happens of itself, unconsciously. But if we hang in there, if we stay with whatever the experience is, it can lead to insight. And this is, you know, what a real relationship of love demands, if there is to be any permanence to it, that what we are projecting on each other will finally be discovered to be part of my own selfhood, and that I cannot demand of the other my image of who the other should be, but rather explore, discover, celebrate, be intrigued by the uniqueness of the other. And what happens in an experience of falling in love and then allowing this to slowly evolve so that it's very different than a brief affair or what's that term they use, the college students use? I can't think of it right now.
A hookup.
Hookup, yeah, a hookup. A hookup is not what I'm talking about.
Well, a good example would be my projection onto you of my brother.
and all the things that he could do, because you were more like him than my father, and you weren't my brother. Very different from my brother. And I had to come to terms with that in myself, because I carried that brother, and I wanted you to be more like him in some ways.
Yes, and I disappointed you gravely. Now, part of what emerges in a sustained relationship is what Jung calls the shadow, the personal shadow side of the personality. And that's, in large part, he says that's the part of us we just don't want to be, or don't want to own, or don't want to look at. And a sustained coupling with another person will demand that we take note, because the shadow, like Lamont Cranston that I grew up with, probably you're all mostly too young. How many ever listened to The Shadow here? Oh, we got a few. Okay, I'm glad to know. How does it go? Do not wonder what lurks in the hearts of men. The shadow knows. One of the comments that Bauer makes is the shadow is not just what a person does not want to be, it is also what a person does not dare to be. And that's part of what a love relationship can inspire and release. We can discover parts of ourselves that have been buried, hidden, imprisoned, but in the breaking free and the passion of our attraction for another human being, these aspects of ourselves which are genuine potentials that we've never dared to embrace as part of ourselves can emerge and can begin to be integrated into who we are. And, you know, that's what one can do for the other, not necessarily by some ego activity, but just through the alchemy and the mystery of relationship. Now I'm going to turn to a book entitled The Wound of the Unloved, written by a German Jungian, and it's rather Germanic in character, a little heavy. He makes the point, and I think it is a valid one, that one way of understanding the wound of the unloved is the cause of a lack of basic trust, which is what Erik Erikson, in his 8 Stages of Ego Development, describes as the very first developmental stage, ego stage of development. And it is the stage where there is an absence of adequate empathic mirroring by the parents, of being seen, being acknowledged, being held, being looked into by mother, and in our day more also by father. And what it creates is a lack of basic trust. Basic trust or basic mistrust is the way he puts it. And that, according to Schellenbaum in this book, is, you know, the wound of the unloved. And it's very difficult for that wound to be healed. I think it can be to some degree, particularly if one is blessed with a meaningful and relatively healthy love relationship. One of the early signs of that unlovedness is the presence of a great deal of shame in many people. Shame is such an enemy of openness and of the expression of the revelation of oneself and the capacity to be engaged with the other, because shame always constricts us. We have to hide. We are the hidden ones when we carry early shame. He says, wherever we were not loved in childhood, we do not love ourselves. And he then says, feeling unloved equals our emotional incapacity to love oneself. And, you know, these are generalizations, but all of you here who are therapists, certainly Anita and I, so many, you know, struggling, suffering human beings come into the consulting room, and it is that wound of the unloved that is at the core of whatever the outer manifestations of their problems in life. He then makes a statement toward the end of the book, and I really like this. Love is abnormal. And what he is saying is love is abnormal to the extent that it potentially annuls all norms. Norms have lost their absolute power over oneself. Loving and liberating are the same things. To fall in love breaks the norms. One of the things that somewhere in my reading describing to be with the other, the beloved, and to be, you know, caught up in such powerful feelings of attraction and love is timeless. Time no longer has its way with you. You are in a timeless space of connection and being. And only when it has to end for one reason or another do you return to time. So it is in that sense what the Greek word kairos means. Unloved children are often subjected to the pressure of parental norms, the pressure is stronger than their love, the parental love. The children are organized rather than loved. I gotta believe in our modern family systems, getting them from soccer practice to music practice to this to that, etc. You can have an hour of TV, so forth and so on. Their lives are organized more sometimes than they are the objects of love. Everything goes by chronos and not kairos in, I think, some very, very busy family systems. And the child is busy and is engaged, but very often there is not time just to be seen, to be known, to be related to be laughed with, to be played with. And that leaves the wound of the unloved. He also writes, only a love that involves liberation towards something new can something, the promise of freedom can foretell or fulfill, I guess. I can't read my own writing here. And that is, again, I think, a very profound insight. Anita and I were out to dinner with an ex-client of mine many years ago. I had helped him out of his fifth marriage, and we were now having dinner with his sixth wife. And he was head of a big corporation and quite an impressive guy, but he did have difficulties in staying in a marriage. A couple of his wives died, and I just wondered about that. But we were having this dinner, and he was in the publishing business, and his wife had been editor of a book review, and had now become a literary agent. And this man was talking to Anita and said, I never would have believed that in my sixth marriage I could be as deeply in love as I am. And I treasure every moment with this wonderful woman. And he married her knowing she had cancer. And she did eventually die, but he treasured every day he could spend with her. And Anita's comment was, well, Thayer and I are in our sixth marriage, too. And she then went on and said, we never could have stayed together if we'd gotten stuck in our first marriage. And so only love that involves liberation towards something new. It is a movement toward growth. It is a movement towards change, towards fairly constant renewal that love demands of us if we're going to be real and be related for 61 years. As I said at Anita's 80th birthday celebration, when I read my little thing about her.
A peon to me.
Peon, right. It was.
I wasn't little.
I said, I cannot say she has never been difficult, but I can say with certainty she has never been boring. So that is a piece of the nature of the love relationship, that it really cannot tolerate being static. It needs to keep moving toward some new expanding, deepening experience. Okay, where am I at? All right. I'm now going to share some thoughts from a book by a man, a Jungian analyst, who's a good friend of ours, Jack Sanford. He has a book. Titled The Invisible Partners. And he's basically drawing on Jung's theoretical concepts of the anima and the animus, the feminine side of a man's nature, which is largely unconscious, and the masculine side of a woman's nature, which is largely unconscious. And part of the dynamic of a love relationship is that over time those elements are forced up into consciousness and become more accessible to our ego awareness, so that I slowly become aware of my inner woman, and a woman becomes aware of her inner man, to use shorthand about it. Jack Sanford says, Jung termed the integration of the shadow the apprentice piece, and the integration of the anima or animus the masterpiece. And I'm going to share a dream I had on my wedding night, because I think it illustrates it so well. At the time, I hadn't been in analysis, and I wasn't going to be in analysis for another 10 years or so. But looking back on it, I came to understand its meaning. Anita and I were married in her hometown of Leominster, and then we drove to Amherst, where I had gone to college and where I had met her on a blind date. She was at Mount Holyoke. And we stayed in the bridal suite of the Lord Jeffrey Inn for our wedding night. And I had a dream. And in the dream, some dark, strange man came and took her away. And I didn't have a clue, really, at the time. It was quite an upsetting dream, needless to say, on my wedding night. Fortunately, since then, I've come to understand it much better, and I think that dark stranger has made a home in me, and now I take her away. But that was a dream about the shadow and the anima. And it showed how unconscious in many ways I was in this adventure of becoming married to this woman. It's not an unusual phenomenon. I haven't run across quite such a dramatic example as I had, but whatever part of us has not yet become conscious or become in some degree integrated into our own sense of self is going to take away or abandon or steal something that is essentially part of oneself. And this gets constellated in a love relationship more intensely than probably most anywhere else. I Sometimes when we're dealing with life and death in some crisis or whatever, I was in combat in the Second World War, and I that raised in me levels of terror and trauma that probably are the only intense parallels to being in love and finally being with the beloved. Sanford then goes on, wherever projection occurs, the person who carries the projected image is either greatly overvalued or greatly undervalued. And I think that's an important thing just in general to keep in mind, that the more we are unconsciously projecting onto someone else, probably the less realistic and accurate our perception of that person is. And, you know, the people we fall in love with, because it happens through falling out of our ego into the unconscious might be as good a way as any, we're going to have to revise our early perceptions in the course of having a real relationship. To the extent that a relationship is founded on projection, the element of human love is lacking. Now, versus being in love, I make a very strong distinction between the passionate attachment, the in-loveness stage of a relationship, and what eventually, hopefully, develops is a capacity for loving. And loving is different than the projective dynamic of in-loveness. I'm not knocking in-loveness, believe me. It's a great trip, but it's just a trip. And the drug wears off. And, you know, it's like, I've forgotten the guru says, first ecstasy, then the laundry.
Cornfield,
right. Many people prefer to go from one person to another, always looking for the ultimate relationship, always leaving the relationship when the projections wear off and the in-loveness ends. And, you know, I could tell stories of a repetitive pattern on the part of either a man or a woman in falling in love with a partner, and then it doesn't work out, and then along comes, you know, another partner who could have been made in the same cookie cutter that the first one was, and they fall in love, and it doesn't, and on and on and on, and the deeper longing in that individual is so unconscious that he or she never gets to it. Sanford makes the important point, most love relationship begins with projection, and this serves life. And I think that's true. I mean, our projections get us involved, get us engaged, and we come alive. And these projections also produce babies. So they continue the human race. The The expression of eros is, in the last analysis, always an individual matter. Von Franz states, no love problem can be solved by following a general principle. If there is a solution, it can only be unique, from individual to individual. Eros, in its essence, is only meaningful if it is completely, uniquely individual. And I made that statement, I'm glad to make it again. I think any durable love relationship that has a growth and a history and acquires its own special secrets and rituals and rhythms is unique. It's ours. It's ours. Belongs to us. And when someone in therapy, you know, shares some of their uniqueness of experience in their love relationship, it always moves me, because it's a sign that they have become individuals, that this is not the Stepford Wives, this is not make-believe, this is authentic connection. Women may welcome a man's anger because it tells them they have gone too far. Where there is emotion, something is happening, and it means the other person is taking part in the relationship. When a man never shows any emotion, it leaves a vacuum in the relationship, especially if he becomes passive. One of the things that used to surprise me, Anita was always more comfortable with anger than I was in my developmental history, and I've given a lecture to this group on anger where I used these illustrations of blowing up. I mean, one time I was just totally enraged, and I was spewing out molten lava, and Anita just stood there and looked me in the eye, and when I finally cooled down a little, I said, boy, you didn't deserve all that. And being the wise woman she is, she says, there, I always knew I was a bitch, but you're just discovering what a bastard you are. And another thing that it used to really confuse me terribly, because, you know, in my family, we just didn't get really angry. It would have upset my mother. And so sometimes when Anita and I would go at it and there was, you know, fire going on between us, and then it would cool down, she'd be grabbing me and trying to pull me out over into the bedroom to make love, where my feelings were I needed to go down to my office like a cave and lick my wounds. And I think this is descriptive in many ways of an essential, I won't universalize this, but an essential difference, I think, between the nature of females and feminine psychology, which is more comfortable with intense affect and more connected in their sense of self with affect. Whereas for men, with our left brain, rational, logical, be reasonable kind of thing, all that affect, coming at me, I feel wounded. I'm bleeding. I've got to go lick my wounds before I can come back and be affectionate. Another example that comes to my mind, I hope you're enduring this, dear.
Well, just wait.
Never boring.
She's going to the next lecture.
Right. There was one time I can remember years ago when we were living down in Westchester County, and I can't remember what started the incident, but she got really mad. And I remember being in the kitchen, maybe I was cooking or cleaning up or whatever, and I said, "Anita, be reasonable." And she said, "Thayer, I'm mad. And I'm going to be mad until I stop being mad. And then I'll be reasonable."
That's right.
I thought that was such a wonderful, honest way of relating. The choice every man or woman makes of a partner for life in some way represents something we need to understand about ourselves. One of the things that I've come to over years of working with couples and being married and having three daughters, but particularly I'm thinking of marriage, our tendency is to marry our core problem. And if we are very fortunate, we are lucky enough to choose a partner with whom we can then negotiate it and fight about it. And if we're really lucky, we can resolve a great deal of it. I am not her brother, and she is not my mother. But it did take me a long time to discover that, and I want to use that as yet another example, because this is such a common issue in love relationships. We're bringing our Oedipal connection to the relationship in one way or another. And my mother was my primary parent, really. And after no more than 20 years of marriage, or thereabouts, I was by then a graduate Jungian analyst and, of course, had achieved a level of consciousness that was quite impressive. I was sitting at the supper table, and Anita said, "Thayer, I'm really getting weary and tired of having you react to me as though I were your mother. You do that, you know, quite often." And I, of course, objected strenuously, being conscious Jungian analyst and well analyzed. And I said, "I don't think I'm relating to you as though you were my mother. I'm relating to you as you are, and sometimes it's a pain." So then, end of the evening, we went to bed, and I had a dream. And dreams and the unconscious can be quite confrontational, but they're good guides. And in the dream, Anita was sitting, I walked into the master bedroom, and Anita was sitting up looking beautiful in bed, and I, in those days, actually wore a suit and a tie, I took off my tie and my jacket and my suit, and I looked over at the bed, and there was my mother sitting up in bed. And so I I took off my clothes and got my pajamas and looked over, and there was Anita sitting in bed. And I went in and brushed my teeth and did my business and came back out, and there was my mother sitting up in bed. So in the morning, in a state that I would describe as chagrin, I sat at the breakfast table and I said, I think I have to revise my reaction of yesterday evening. And I told her the dream. And she just sort of smiled and nodded and said, well, you do trust your unconscious. And I said, yes, I've learned a lesson. And fortunately, I never had to have another dream like that. But it is so illustrative of what goes on in relationships. When a couple comes to me to have joint therapy, basically what I say to them in the first session is, now you've come because you are having a problem in your relationship with each other. Is that right? And of course they nod, yeah, that's what we want to talk about. I said, well, I certainly hope we can get to that sooner or later. But I want you to understand that you have just brought at least 5 relationships into the room when you sit down facing each other. First and foremost is the relationship that each of your parents had with each other. That is your embedded, imprinted model of marriage, of relationship. And unconsciously, much more than you're aware, I suspect, at this point, you are reenacting the parental marriage in your relationship with each other. So we're going to have to look at your parents' marriage and, you know, uncover what its real dynamic was and how you experienced it, so that you don't unconsciously bring that to your love for each other. Then the next pair is the Oedipal relationship of each of you. I'm talking here, you know, about a man and a woman, but it could be 2 men or 2 women. It would still have many of the same meanings, I think. And I said, pointing to the husband, your relationship to your mother is in this room with us, in your relationship with your wife. And pointing to the wife, your relationship with your father is in the room with us here, in your relation to your husband. And then finally, there is your relationship with each other as individuals. And I hope we can get there, because I believe if we can unload a lot of that baggage, you're going to find a lot more room to breathe and to discover each other. So that, I mean, my dream about my mother is an example of that. I'm going to move on now to a book entitled, somewhere it is, here it is, Passionate Attachments, Talking About Love. And this has got a lot of therapists and commentators on love. And I picked out a few things here. Some of this will be repetitive to what I've already said. One of the most powerful aspects of a new passionate relationship is the formation of a new sense of self. When we fall in love, we encounter a new part of ourselves, a new dimension to who we really are. It brings out part of some inner truth in us that has not previously been adequately a part of our sense of conscious identity. Then the next one is passionate love in healthy form is passionate love in healthy form is not enduring. In other words, it lasts for a while. Sometimes it can be quite a long while. And under the best of circumstances, gives way to its more muted counterpart, affectionate love. I'm not sure that affection quite captures. I think it's a little more juicy than that, wouldn't you say? It transforms itself into another. It goes from being in love to loving, and loving can go very deep. The older we get, the deeper we go. It's a marvelous adventure. But it's not where we began, and it's definitely not a hookup. Or if it is, it's a 61-year hookup. I'm hung up on my hookup. One of the interesting things I hadn't thought of, I came across in this book, the median duration of marriage, how long a marriage lasts, is the same as 150 years ago. Only difference is, then it was death, now it's divorce. One of the cultural issues we have to deal with is, I mean, I'm about to be 87 in March, and Nita is 83 in February. My father died at 61, my mother at 67. My grandparents died earlier than that. You know, in the 16th century, in the book of the Anglican Book of Common Prayer in the marriage service, you know, in sickness and health, in wealth and poverty, I can't even remember the words, till death us do part. Well, the average age for a woman, I think, was around 38, 37, 36. For a man, maybe 45. Women, so many women died in childbirth that many of them died younger than their husband. But that's how long that marriage was going to last. So there was some reasonableness to those words. 61 years with the same person? Can you believe it?
No, I think if I'd known that in my wedding gown, I would have hightailed it out of the tree.
So we're faced in our culture with a very different chronological temporal reality where a marriage that, you know, I had a man client, I had worked with his wife, and then when she finished with me, and actually she became a Jungian analyst, she sent her husband to me, and by the time the husband came, or they had separated and divorced. They had five children, and when he started working with me, and I heard his story, and I'd heard her story, he had a terrible. He was a very conscientious guy. And he talked so much about how he had failed at marriage. And, you know, he was in his 60s by then, I think, or 50s, somewhere around there. And the more, you know, I knew both sides of the story, and I said, you're really carrying around the till death, at death us do part bit, aren't you? And he smiled and he said, yeah, I guess I am. I said, I talked about our culture and how different our situation was in the 16th century. And I also said, is it possible for you to think about that a marriage could die, it could be alive, and then it dies a natural death, that you move in different directions in the middle of your lives, and it no longer is a living connection between you? But it was when it produced five kids, and the two of you still celebrate holidays together. And I said, get over it. You know, you don't have to hang in there till you die if, in fact, the relationship has had an organic death. And many relationships do. And that's just part of stages of our lives, where different values, different interests, different visions of what the meaning of our life is, cause us to go in different paths. And it relieved him, and I actually then conducted a wedding. I married him to quite a much younger woman, and they had many good years together. They were madly in love with each other, and then he died. But they were glad for every year they had together. So. That's that. Another book, Jane Goldberg, The Dark Side of Love. This chapter in The Dark Side of Marriage. We Americans like happy endings. Marriages, however, have realistic endings. Our challenge is to accept the happiness of compromise rather than to relentlessly pursue the unattainable ideal. And this is really, it goes back to what Hillman said about we bring our theologies to a relationship. And if it's a very rigid theology or ideology, it can end a marriage simply because there isn't enough openness to change and compromise. Marriage represents a death because it is only in the renunciation of infantile narcissism that cooperative love relationships can grow. Legitimate relationships can take place only when the distinction between self and other exists. Now, the psychological basis for that statement is that psychological narcissism means that the other is really an extension of my own self system. It's not a real other. It's not unique, mysterious, autonomous, but my narcissistic need to be mirrored and to have the other be an extension of a part of me puts terrible demands on the other partner. And sooner or later, unless the other partner chooses to be voiceless and selfless and a victim for the rest of his or her life, the marriage is going to end. And what is demanded, that there be a distinction between self and other. I thou relationship, a discovering the mystery of another human being's essence is part of the adventure and the excitement of a real love relationship. Just as it is a profound respect for the other's autonomy. Rilke, the German poet, I think in his letters to a young poet, he writes, "Love's essence is the capacity of the lover to stand guard over the beloved's solitude." I often have quoted that when I've married people in my occasional role still as a parson. And it is so essential to the nature of a durable, continuing love that there be a profound respect for the other's interiority, solitude, and that you value that as much as you value the interactive, relational, energetic field. The writer Goldberg quotes Maggie Scharf, "It is in marriage that we resurrect not only the intensity of our first attachment feelings," that means going back to our early childhood, "but the miseries of old frustrations, repressed hatreds, as well. And what is so frequently sought out in a mate and then fought out with that mate is some unresolved and thus unconscious dilemma about a parent or a brother.
Or a mother.
Yes. Yes. Or a father." Goldberg writes, "The reason that marriage is so beneficial is that it is so difficult. In a momentary encounter, it is easy to hide the regressed aspects of one's personality. In a marital relationship, however, these unresolved aspects of one's psychological functioning invariably come to light one by one." They almost march in the door. Freud calls it the return of the repressed.
Claire, do you need to leave some time?
I am planning to, dear.
Okay.
It's nice to have a permanent manager.
You've always rebelled against that.
I've got incredibly more to say, but I'm not going to get there. I knew I wouldn't.
That's what I'm concerned about.
Let me just briefly... there's a book by Verena Cast,
is it the one way underneath? It's the one way underneath.
No, it's not. Oh. That one. I thought I brought it. Here it is. Entitled "The Nature of Loving: Patterns of Human Relationship." She's a wonderful Swiss Jungian analyst. And what she does in this book, and I'm just going to give you very brief description, is she takes archetypal models of love relationship. In other words, the first one is Shiva and Shakti. And she says, the ideal of relationship that the two embody is, whether perceived or not, the guiding image of all love, the negation of separateness. Shiva and Shakti are everything to each other, and their relationship completely excludes the outside world. The eternal embrace symbolizes the human wish to overcome and deny responsibility for individuality. The problems of separation eventually emerge. It is love without words, to be understood without need to speak or reveal oneself. So that's one model, and its major problem, which is autonomy, separateness. Then there's the Pygmalion fantasy. I love your future form, the wish to make something of one's partner. You know, oh, I'm deeply in love with him, and I'm sure that I can help him to change. Forget it. I might add, this is also a very important, relevant image in the attitude of a therapist towards a client, towards an analysand. If the therapist has images of how this client could or ought to change, they're in trouble. Then there's Ishtar and Tammuz, the older woman, young man, the fertility goddess and sun lover, the renewal of the springtime of love and its transitory nature. Every year there's another sun lover. The past one gets neutralized, as they said on TV. Then there's Zeus and Hera. Conflict, domination, power and control, struggle, win-lose, one-upsmanship. Verena Koss suggests that Hera seems to feel unheard and misunderstood and in need of reminding Zeus that she is a goddess. Anita went to Esalen for a month back in 1976, and she did a tarot drawing when she was out there. And I can't remember how you phrased this, but I said, so, anyway, I thought she
drew the Empress.
Yeah, I thought she'd drawn the Goddess Guard, and she said, no, fair.
No, the Empress out.
She said, I drew the Empress card. I said, uh-oh. Exercise of power and control have taken the place of love. Instead of idealizing, they devalue. Yet this couple feels very close to each other. They fantasize about separation. She's talking about a particular Zeus and Hera marriage she worked with. They fantasize about separation, but they do not want it. Fighting for them leads to closeness and delineation from each other. Anita and I have often thought that we're closer to Zeus and Hera than the others.
There, wouldn't that be, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Wouldn't that be?
Could be. Yeah. Okay. Then there's Merlin and Vivian. the wise old man and the young girl. And she says, when a couple is composed of an old man and a young girl, or an old woman and a young boy, the renewal of life is a central issue. Okay, I'm not going to get to a lot of stuff, but the one other thing I would mention without going into the details at all is Jung's understanding of typology. I don't know how many of you are familiar with his theory of types. That would take another whole evening, really. But, for example, I am an extroverted, intuitive, feeling perceiver. Anita is an introverted, sensate,
feeler, thinker,
perceiver. We're both perceivers. But we are quite opposite. They did some research with the Gray Wheelwright typology instrument, not the Myers-Briggs one, which is the nationally used. I mean, they've been given to millions of people. Probably many of you have taken it. And they tested 3,000 couples with the Gray Wheelwright test, and 90% of the couples were opposite types. Meanwhile, their closest friends and their extramarital lovers were the same types, as you would expect. So part of what happens in this pull toward the other is that each of us is half conscious and half dotted line unconscious. We find somebody who fills in with a conscious line, our dotted line, and we fill in their dotted line. And we are one and whole and together until we break apart. And we then, down the road in our relationship, we each have to develop as best we can the unconscious sides of our typology, because that's where the most vitality and energy in a relationship is going to be found. That's all I can say about it, but that is an important element in love relationships. Okay, we've got about 20 minutes. I hope that I've stirred up some imagination and reaction. You didn't look like you'd gone to sleep. Come on. Okay. You sure there's no question?
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
I see questions. Yeah, in the back.
When you described your experience with the couple in the room with you, you said there were at least 5 relationships there, and I only got 3 of them. Your parents' relationship, the Oedipal relationship, and your relationship with each other.
No, each parental relationship.
Oh,
there are
2
okay. parental. And then there are 2 Oedipal. And then the relationship between the two in the room. Yeah. You had a question.
Yeah. What is the median length of a marriage now, which is the same as 150 years ago? Approximately. I have no idea.
That's a good question. And offhand, I'm sure that somewhere in these pages, John Gottman has written. He's the most famous writer on couples. He's done the most research. I think one figure, if I remember, he said Within 40 years of marriage, 67% of married couples have gotten divorced.
Within 40 years?
Within 40 years. That's a one figure. But I don't know what the median would be. I'd 50% of first marriages end, but I'm not sure how long before they end. I think we're getting a little better. If I may present a political bias for a moment, one of the things I find interesting is that the blue states in the U.S. have the fewest divorces, the red states have the most. And the red states are where all the preserving marriage and rigid morals exist. And I find that very interesting. And Massachusetts is the lowest. So, yeah.
I was sort of struck by something new in round thinking when you were talking about the projection that goes on in falling in love. And in my Jungian headset, I always think of that projection as being the positive things we project onto the other and then fall in love with. And tonight, I thought, it's not only the positive, it's the negative also that we project onto the one who we're falling in love with. And in that complementarity, I think, is something new and something old, something transferential or of the parents, and something of the potential, the newness in the actual person. And so it was just fun to have that thought in response to you.
Well, thank you for that. I think that's a very wise and insightful observation. And I think I tried to capture a bit of that in saying, if we're fortunate, we marry our core problem, and we do it with someone with whom it can be worked through. And in that sense, there is a positive sense of potential and possibility and something opening up, something new, something moving forward. And at the same time, it's going to bring up the dark side of our own early developmental experience of all the things I've talked about tonight. But yeah, what's important is that to the extent that it's possible, we have some inner marriage, some inner balance, some inner dialogue between the light side and the dark side of our own natures, so that we can meet our partner with a level of relative comfort and flexibility in meeting their bright side and their dark side. You see, if it's all bright, then we're in big trouble. One of my major mentors that trained me used to say, the shinier the face, the smellier the feet.
Who might that be? The mentor.
That's a man named Edward Whitmont, who's written a great many. He was a very gifted Jungian analyst in New York who trained me and then became one of my colleagues and very good friends. There was something I was going to add that got stirred by that, and I can't think what it is.
Another Jungian, Guggenbuhl Craig, you probably don't have his book, it's an old sort of forest chestnut, Marriage Dead or Alive. And he talks about how the emotional And when I work with couples, you know, I say it may seem like it's may hurt the other person, and you know they've held so many things back because they are scared it's going to hurt the other person. But with a referee, they can say what they actually feel in the moment, and that can release so much, because then you can get at the essence of the other person and know exactly. It doesn't mean through dialogue it isn't going to change, but anger particularly is a difficult one very often when I do couples work. And that can be very tricky because it is hard to work with, creatively, I think. Yeah. But for someone to come out and say, you know, I was just so angry with you the other night, and not to have said that when it was happening, I mean, that can start real life happening again between couples.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the areas in which Anita and I had our marriage chart done by two different astrologers.
Before.
What?
Before marriage?
No. Oh. No. Well after. And when we went in to get the results, the feedback, each of them practically in their first sentence said, "You two fight a lot, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, we're quite confrontational. Where do you see that in the chart?" They said, "Oh, it's pretty clear. Your house of marriage is governed by the god of war, Mars." So, and, you know, that wasn't my mother, and that wasn't your mother or
no,
your father.
Either one of our parents.
Yeah. So, for us to react, to effectively express what you're feeling in the moment, becomes just a natural part of being related. And it is an expression, in our terms, of how much we love each other, because we don't hold back. Is that fair?
That's very fair, yeah.
One of the questions I'm often asked, you know, what is the bottom line key? What's the fundamental issue and need for a long-term, durable relationship? And my answer is the capacity on the part of each partner to engage in an individuation dialogue. I think that's about as brief and inclusive a way of getting at the core. An individuation dialogue is to speak your truth, to be open to the other's truth, to be emotionally engaged, intellectually engaged. And this can happen in any number of unique forms, but that sense of being accountable to the other and taking full account of the other, I guess, is a way of capturing it. Any other? Yeah.
I already asked a question, if you want to go.
Oh. Go ahead.
Thanks. First of all, I want to say congratulations on surviving Anita's going to Esalen in the 70s for a month. That
exactly.
Would be challenging in those days. And I had two, but here's one. As someone who had a 34-year relationship end just before I was 60, I was struck by, well, here you are, you know, with a 61-year relationship. And a successful one with conflict, you know, enjoying the conflict, growing from the conflict. And yet you also said about
well, some couples are sort of meant to. It's not like an automatic. It's not a failure, you know, to have a marriage end. Values change, directions change, and maybe even that growing edge just changes, where you are no longer meant to help each other grow. You know?
I think so. That's a good point.
Yeah, I like that.
We've talked about divorce. I mean, I think any good marriage wonders about that.
There was a point, probably 25 years into our marriage, where we were dealing with real difficulties, and we were raising the question with each other, you know, are we meant to endure? Are we meant to be together for the long haul? And so we both take seriously the I Ching. I don't know whether you're familiar with the I Ching, but we got down on the floor and we cast 3 pennies 6 times, about each of us 3 times. And we got hexagram 32. No changing lines. Just right on. Duration. It is one of the 4 hexagrams out of the 64 in the I Ching that is directly related to marriage. And it had my consistent trigram that I used to get, which is the arousing thunder, and Anita's consistent trigram, which is the gentle penetrating wind.
Sun, S-U-N.
What?
S-U-N, Sun.
Sun, right. I can't remember what mine is in Chinese, but anyway.
Chen.
Okay, Chen.
It's mine too.
Oh, is that right? I'm not surprised. So, when we read that, the thing that it discusses, I'm giving you a very brief summary, is that thunder and wind have a constant relationship to each other, but they are powerfully transient over any static landscape or surface. They move, but they move together. They're connected to each other intrinsically. And I can remember reading that, and Anita and I got it immediately, and I said, okay, dear, we can't argue with God. So here we are. And for us, I think it's fair to say this stage in our lives, the last 15, 20 years, time came to Amherst 19 years ago in January, and this has been such a rich period in our lives. You know, we do talks on aging. I think we've done one here, actually. That there are now not just 2 stages in life, but there are 3 stages, because we're growing. So many of us are growing older. And the 3rd stage of life is just as much a developmental stage as the other two. You know, this image of people sitting around we do give organ recitals to each other, I'm sure. You know what that means, it's a whole new stage in consciousness when you get to be an old codger and a hag.
Those are
archetypes. Hag is Hagia. I mean, Hagia Sophia. I mean, this is a marvelous thing. I've got bastardized by men by calling us hags.
Yes.
But it's really refers to wisdom.
Crone.
The crone, yeah. In the best sense of the word, I'm a crone.
That is what I meant, but I knew I'd get that reaction. Okay, we got to stop. Thank you for being so attentive. I appreciate it.